This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Crown's Game by Evelyn Skye, performed by Steve West. The Crown's Game is an old one, older than the Tsardom itself. It began long ago, in the age of Rurik, Prince of Novgorod. Russia was still a cluster of tribes, wild and lawless and young. As the country matured over the centuries, so too did the game. But always, always, it retained its untamed fierceness. For the winner of the game, there would be unimaginable power. For the defeated, desolate oblivion. The Crown's Game was not one to lose. Chapter 1, October 1825. The smell of sugar and yeast welcomed Vika, even before she stepped into the pumpkin-shaped shop on the main street of their little town. She resisted the urge to burst into Cinderella Bakery. Her father had labored for 16 years to teach her how to be demure, and she slipped into the shop and took her place quietly at the end of the line of middle-aged women. One of them turned to greet her, but shrank away when she saw it was Vika, as people always did. It was as if they suspected that what ran through her veins was not blood, as in the rest of them, but something hotter and more volatile that might burn any who came too near. Her wild red hair with its streak of jet black down the center likely did nothing to settle the women either. The only thing normal about Vika was her dress. The pretty, albeit rumpled, green gown her father insisted she wear whenever she went into town, minus the dreadful yellow ribbon that cinched her waist too tightly, which she'd rather conveniently lost in Preobrazhensky Creek. Vika smiled at the woman, though it came out as a half-smirk. The woman huffed at Vika's impudence, then turned forward again in line. Vika allowed herself a full smirk now. When all the women in line had been served and had fled the bakery, "Fled from me," Vika thought with a shrug. Ludmila Fanina, the plump baker behind the counter, turned her attention to her.
"Privet, my darling Vika,"
Ludmila said, drawing out her name in operatic song. She was the only one in Ovchinen Island, besides Vika's father, who met Vika's eyes when she saw her. The baker continued singing.
"How are you this fine morning?"
Vika applauded, and Ludmila bobbed in an awkward curtsy. She bumped into a tray of Oreshki cookies, and the caramel walnut confections teetered on the edge of the counter. Typical Ludmila. Vika furtively charmed the tray to keep its balance.
"Ochen karasho, spasibo,"
Vika said. "I'm very well, thank you." She spoke in Russian, unlike the aristocrats in St. Petersburg, who preferred the more sophisticated French. Her father might have been nobility, Baron Sergei Mikhailovich Andreev, to be exact, but he wanted his daughter to grow up truly Russian, hiking through birch forests, playing the balalaika, and having an almost religious zeal for buckwheat kasha with mushrooms and fresh butter. It was why they lived on this rural island, rather than in the imperial capital, because Sergei swore that living on Ovchinen Island kept them closer to the heart of their country.
"And how are you?"
Vika asked Ludmila.
"Oh, quite well, now that you've brought a ray of sunshine into my shop," the baker said in a normal voice. "The usual for Sergei. But of course, It's the only thing Father will eat for breakfast.
Ludmila laughed as she fetched a Borodinsky loaf, the dense Russian black bread that was Sergei's daily staple. She wrapped the bread in brown paper, creased the corners, and tied it with cotton twine. Vika paid and tucked the bread into her basket, which contained a few sausages from the butcher and a jar of dill pickles from the grocer two streets down, where she had stopped earlier.
Thank you,
she said, already halfway outside. She adored Ludmila, but the bakery walls were too thick and the air too humid, like sitting in a sauna for a few minutes too long. It was much better to be outdoors, where there were no boundaries placed on her.
See you tomorrow. Until then, Vika,
Ludmila sang, as the door to the bakery swung shut. Vika stumbled as she hurried up the narrow dirt path that wound through the hills of Ovchinin Island and into the woods. She was supposed to maintain a practiced calm when she was out where people could see her, but it was difficult. Sergei said it was because Vika was like a ginny whose bottle was too small to contain her.
One day, I'll create a world where there are no bottles at all, she thought.
For now, she wanted to get back to her father, and to the challenge he designed for her. As Vika crossed the perimeter of the forest, she leaned forward, muscles set yet relaxed, like a veteran racehorse on the starting line.
2 more years, she thought. 2 more years of training, and my magic will be powerful enough to serve the Tsar and the Empire.
Maybe then her figurative ginny bottle would finally be big enough. Vika jumped over logs and wove through moss-covered rocks. As she hurdled over Preobrazhensky Creek, which burbled as if it had its own lesson to hurry to, she spotted her father, sitting on a log. His tunic and trousers were muddy from his morning spent digging up valerian root. There were leaves in his beard, and he was whittling a chunk of wood. Never had a baron looked so much like a peasant. Vika smiled.
The bread smells delicious, Sergei said,
angling his nose at Vika's basket. She grinned.
Perhaps I'll let you have some in exchange for starting my lesson.
16 years, and still no patience.
The laugh lines around her father's eyes deepened, as if his plow had gone straight from his vegetable fields onto his weathered brown skin.
You confuse impatience with enthusiasm, Vika mock-scolded. Just because I'm the only enchanter in the Empire doesn't mean I'm going to rest on my laurels.
Her father dipped his head, conceding her point.
Have you put up the shield?
Of course.
She'd had lessons for a decade now, ever since she was old enough to understand that enchanting was not only for fun, but also for serving Russia and the Tsar. Casting an invisible barrier around the forest before starting a lesson was something she did automatically, without a thought. Still, Vika glanced over her shoulder to make sure a villager hadn't strayed into the woods. Her entire life, her father had hammered into her that people had been burned at the stake for much less than what she could do. And Vika didn't fancy a death engulfed in flames. But no one was in the woods today. That was another reason they lived on this tiny forest of an island. There were but a few hundred people on Ovchinin Island, and they all lived on the flatlands near the harbor. Up here in the hills, it was only Sergei, a mild-mannered scientist obsessed with medicinal herbs, and Vika, his doting, if not entirely obedient, daughter.
All right, her father said. I'd like you to create a lightning storm. No need for rain, just dry lightning. And aim for that tree.
He pointed to a birch 20 feet away.
Why?
He shook his head, but there was a gleam in his eyes.
You know better than to ask why.
Which was true. He wasn't going to tell her what the lesson was. That would ruin the surprise. Besides, Vika liked surprises. Behind her, something darted out of the shrubbery. Vika spun toward it, hands poised to freeze whatever it was. But it was only a pheasant dashing into another bush. Nothing unusual, and certainly not the start of her lesson. She laughed, and her voice echoed through the wispy white trees. But when she turned back to the log where Sergei had been sitting, there was only empty space.
Father?
Huh? Where had he gone? Then again, this was not out of the ordinary. Sergei often removed himself from the scene of the lesson, so she could work things out herself. He was probably somewhere safely away from her impending lightning storm. Speaking of which, the lightning wasn't going to summon itself. Vika set down her basket, raised her arms, and focused on the invisible particles of electricity in the sky. They flitted around like sparks of static dust, content to whirl through the air by themselves. But that wasn't what she wanted.
Come together, she willed them. Come and play with me.
The sky hummed, and then out of the clear blue came a deafening crack that split the silence. Vika covered her ears at the same time the lightning hit the birch tree 20 feet away and lit the trunk on fire. As soon as the bolt struck, a silver wire flared. It had been camouflaged among the leaves, but now, as electricity blazed through it, Vika saw that the wire connected the first birch to a ring of 50 others. The initial fire spread so quickly, it was as if lightning had struck every single tree. Her father might not have had much magic. He was a mentor, not an enchanter, so he could only manage small-scale conjuring and charms. But he was expert at setting elaborate traps. Vika was surrounded by flames and bitter smoke. The tree trunks teetered. Vika smiled.
Here we go.
As one of the trees began to fall, Vika shoved her hands outward to force the wind to push the tree back upright. It would have worked if only one tree were falling. But there were 50 or so birches, all seething with fire and ash and toppling toward her at a speed too quick for her to reverse the motions of them all.
What to do? What to do?
The trees were nearly upon her.
Water. No. Ice.
Vika flung herself to the forest floor and waved her arm over her head, generating a dome of ice around her. She trembled as tree after tree slammed into her shield and sent icy shards stabbing into her neck and back. Crimson rivulets of blood trickled down the bodice of her dress. Vika squeezed her eyes shut. The fiery assault seemed to last an eternity, and yet she held her position. Then, finally, the last trunk crashed into her ice shield. The earth shuddered, and the sky ceased to thunder. Her smile burned even brighter. Chapter 2 Sergei sat on a nearby boulder the entire time Vika was crouched beneath her shield of ice. If he could, he would have helped her. But he couldn't. It was part of her training. She would face dangers greater than this when she became Imperial Enchanter. At the end of 5 hours, Vika had charmed the last of the 50 fallen trees to rise off her shelter, and the ice melted. She emerged in a puddle, shivering. She clucked her tongue at Sergei.
Father, you could have killed me.
You know I would never do that. If I did, who would fetch my bread from the bakery every morning?
Well, the joke is on you, for it's well past noon now, and you left your bread with me.
Vika winked as she reached into her basket and tossed him the icy loaf. He defrosted it as it flew through the air, and it was toasty by the time he caught it.
You know I wouldn't do anything that could kill you. But the Tsar isn't looking for someone to perform parlor tricks. Yes, there will be fancy balls and state dinners, for which your aesthetic talents will be called upon. But there will also be politics and backstabbing and war. A smile bloomed across Vika's face.
A little peril has never stopped me.
She tipped her head toward the charred remains of the bonfire.
In fact, it makes me want to be Imperial Enchanter even more.
Sergei shook his head and laughed. I know. You're fiery and you like things even better when they are challenging. Just like your mother did. Nothing is too daunting for you, Vikotchka. She wrinkled her nose at the nickname. It was too cute for her now that she was grown, but Sergei couldn't help it. He still remembered when she was a baby, so small he could fit her in his cupped palms. When she was younger, Vika had sometimes lamented not having other magical children with whom to play. But she quickly outgrew that, for Sergei had explained that it made her special, and not only in Russia. Most of the world had forgotten about magic, and so enchanters had grown rarer. It was rumored that Morocco had an enchanter, as their sultan was a patron of the old ways. But that was it, really, besides the Tsar, who tried to keep his own belief in mysticism quiet. It was a political liability to believe in the occult. Besides, concealing the fact that he had an imperial enchanter allowed the Tsar a secret weapon against his enemies. Not that it was foolproof. Imperial enchanters were still human, as evidenced by the unexpected death 20 years ago of the previous enchanter, Yakov Zinchenko, in the battle against Napoleon at Austerlitz. Once, when Vika was 6 and just beginning her lessons, she had asked why Sergei wasn't the imperial enchanter. My magic is much too small, he'd answered, which was the truth, but only part of it. He'd swallowed the rest, a secret he kept for himself and hoped she'd never have to know.
But my magic is big,
Vika had asked, oblivious.
The biggest, Sergei had said. And I will teach you as best I can to become the greatest enchanter there ever was.
Now, 10 years later, and 100 times more powerful, Vika asked,
Are you worried I won't be ready to become Imperial Enchanter?
Sergei sighed.
No, I didn't say that. I only meant... Well, I want to keep you here on Ovchinen Island. For selfish reasons. I'd rather not share you with the Tsar.
Oh, Father, you're all gruff beard on the outside, but mush on the inside. Wonderful, sentimental mush.
She smiled in that way she used to when she was small, eyes big and innocent. Well, as innocent as was possible for Vika. Sergei crossed the muddy patch of forest between them and wrapped his arms around her.
I do not envy you. It is a burdensome calling to be the Tsar's enchanter. Promise me you'll remain my mischievous Vikotchka, no matter what the future may bring.
I swear it.
Vika touched a finger to the basalt pendant around her neck. It was something she did for the most unbreakable of promises, because swearing on her dead mother's necklace seemed to lend solemnity to any commitment. It was also a tad theatrical, and Vika was fond of self-aware melodrama. Still, Sergei knew that the few promises she'd ever made on the necklace were sworn in complete earnestness.
But you know, Vika said as she pulled away from his embrace, I wouldn't mind leaving the island once in a while, or ever.
I don't like St. Petersburg, he said.
What about Finland? It's not far.
The Grand Duchy of Finland does not interest me at all.
It might interest me.
I am sure you will do plenty of traveling once your Imperial Enchanter. But my time with you is limited. Humor an old man and stay on the island with me a bit longer. It's only 7 more seasons until you turn 18. Vika chewed on her lip. Sergei braced himself. He knew that glint in her eyes. When you had an enchantress as a daughter, disagreements often became more demonstrative than mere words. Suddenly, the red and orange leaves around them fluttered to the forest floor, and autumn rushed away. Then a blast of snow set in on the bare branches. A moment later, the icicles melted, and flower buds shot out of the damp ground and blossomed in full perfume. They were quickly replaced by the lush greenery of summer, then autumn again, and winter, and spring, all in less than a minute.
"Looks like 7 seasons have passed," Vika said.
Sergei crossed his arms over his chest. "Vikochka!"
"Oh, fine."
She changed the season back to autumn, as it should be. The leaves on the birch trees were golden once again.
"Is it truly so unbearable to be here with me?"
"No, of course not, Father. I just..."
"I'll challenge you even more in your lessons."
Vika perked up.
"Really?"
"As much as you'd like."
"I'd like to be a menace to anyone who dares to trouble Russia."
"You already are a menace."
Vika pecked Sergei on the cheek.
"Then make me a bigger one."
Chapter 3 Nikolai's pocket watch clicked as the hour struck 2 in the morning. He ought to have gone to bed long ago, but here he still was, standing in front of a trifold mirror in his bedroom, as a measuring tape and several pins flew around him, designing a new frock coat. For a once pudgy orphan from the Kazakh steppe, Nikolai had grown up to be rather striking. His eyes were dark and fierce, his face and body all sharp planes, and yet there was an impossible fluidity to the way he moved. In fact, even in the way he stood, that was both incongruous with his trenchant edges and an inseparable part of his being. It was a brooding sort of elegance not often seen on a boy of 18. The clothing he tailored was, of course, necessary for life in the heart of the capital. There was always an invitation to lunch, or to play cards, or to go to the countryside to hunt. But Nikolai had had to fend for himself in every one of these realms. For his mentor and benefactor, Countess Galina Zakrevskaya, was not about to spend a kopeck on him for new boots or a proper rifle for shooting grouse, and certainly not for dance lessons. Even though Galina's friends deemed it fashionable to invite her charity case to their balls. And so Nikolai had learned to barter. He delivered packages for the tailors at Bisset and Sons in exchange for bolts of cloth. He sharpened swords for an army lieutenant in return for lessons. He served as an unpaid assistant to Madame Allard, the ballroom instructor to all the debutantes, and as a result, learned to dance in the company of the prettiest girls in the city. Nikolai knew he was worth at least the same as the noble-born boys in the capital, and he refused to give anyone an excuse to prove otherwise. So while Nikolai might not have belonged to St. Petersburg society, he was in it, in his own ill-fitting way. And all the while, Galina's daft admirers praised her for her caritas, and her ability to polish a rough Kazakh stone into the semblance of a proper Petersburg jewel. Galina did not correct them. Now Nikolai stood very still, while his scissors hovered above a mahogany table on the other side of the room. Cutting through a panel of black wool, he pointed at the scissors to slice a notch in the lapel. Before they had a chance, though, Galina barged into his room. It was her house he lived in, after all, and halted the scissors in midair.
"Arrête!"
she spoke French, just as she had the first time he met her, when he was a child and still living in a nomadic village on the Kazakh steppe. Then French had been gibberish to him. But now the language was second nature, and Nikolai was rather proud that he spoke it without an accent. All the aristocracy in St. Petersburg spoke French. Nikolai shifted from his position in front of the mirrors, where the cloth tape was still busily flying about.
"No step in the lapels," Galina said. "But I like them notched. For informal frock coats, that is acceptable. But this one ought to be formal, and make it double-breasted."
Nikolai bit the inside of his cheek. How utterly like Galina to deny him something as simple as notched lapels. But he swirled his hand in the air as he relayed new instructions to his scissors. They repositioned themselves and began snipping again.
"Actually, we don't have time for this."
Galina clapped her hands three times, which made the jeweled bangles on her wrists jingle, and the woolen scissors vanished.
"Hey, get dressed to go out and meet me downstairs in 5 minutes. It's time for a lesson." "It's 2 o'clock in the morning."
Galina shrugged and glided out of his room. Nikolai sighed. Ever since her husband, the old war hero, Count Mikhail Zakrevsky, had died 6 years ago, Galina had grown even more intractable than she'd been before. So it was no accident that Nikolai had turned out a touch morose. He'd endured Galina's lack of pity for a sum total of 11 years. Nikolai eyed his bed. Without the project of his frock coat, a curtain of fatigue suddenly threatened to drop over him. His pillows crooned a siren song. He could refuse Galina's command. It was inhumane to train at this hour. But if he disobeyed, he would have to leave, because he was only given a place in the Zakrevsky house, as long as he was Galina's student. And he could not give that up, because studying with her was his ticket to becoming more than a no-name orphan. He could be Imperial Enchanter someday. However, it wouldn't be as easy as knocking on the Winter Palace door and asking for the job. Well, it would have been if Nikolai were the only enchanter in Russia. But it so happened that there had been 2 enchanters born after the last one perished. It was an anomaly, having more than 1 enchanter at a time, but not completely unprecedented. Like Mother Nature's occasional deviations from the norm, so Russia's magic sometimes gifted the empire with a pair of enchanters, rather than only one. But there was a solution for that.
"It's a game,"
Galina had told Nikolai when she'd taken him under her tutelage.
"The one with the best magic wins."
He'd been only 7 when Galina came to the Kazakh steppe, the border between Asia and the Russian Empire, and she'd been unlike any woman Nikolai had ever seen. A dainty hat perched atop carefully coiffed brown curls, a voluminous gown made of iridescent purple fabric that shimmered in the sweltering midday sun, and preposterously high-heeled boots that looked like an accident waiting to happen on the uneven terrain of the grassy steppe. An accident, that is, if the woman were actually walking. Nikolai twisted the hem of his tunic as he studied her. He focused on the space between the ground and the soles of her tiny feet, and discovered that there was, indeed, a space between, if only inches. She levitated and merely moved her legs to create the illusion of walking. And she did so without seeming aware of it, as if the movement had been a part of her for decades. Nikolai grinned and puffed out his chest. The other children in the village wouldn't have noticed. They would simply have thought the woman was preternaturally graceful. When she floated to a stop in front of him seconds later, she stooped, although still hovering, and asked,
"C'est toi que je cherche?"
Nikolai tilted his head, and the fringe of his dark hair fell in his face. He could not understand the woman's language. The woman muttered something to herself. Then she spoke again, this time in halting Russian, as if she had learned it by eavesdropping on others, but not actually speaking it herself.
Eto ti?
Are you the one I'm looking for? Nikolai screwed up his face at her pronunciation.
I am the Countess Galina Zakhrevskaya, she said, and I have come for you. Where are your parents? Mama died when I was born,
Nikolai said without regret. He had not known her, so he had not had the opportunity to form an attachment.
And my father is also long gone.
Galina nodded, as if she had expected as much.
Then you are all alone? I have the village.
Nikolai pointed behind him at the cluster of colorful yurts, round tents decorated with brightly colored patterns, woven in a rainbow of zigzags and stripes.
I doubt they will mind one less mouth to feed, Galina said.
Which was true. The villagers had traded him to Galina all too easily, in exchange for 2 horses and 2 sheep. They'd been happy to be rid of the boy with powers they did not understand, that seemed to them to stem from the devil. So now, even though Nikolai grumbled as he glanced at his pocket watch and at the empty space where his scissors and cloth had just been, he only half meant the curses he swore under his breath.
I didn't come all this way from the steppe, only to revert to a sheepherder, he thought. And I certainly don't intend to continue as an errand boy.
He commanded the ivory inlaid doors of his armoire to open, and clothes flew out to meet him. He didn't know what Galina had planned, but he did know he needed to be more than presentable. She was very particular about appearances, which was ironic, given that she'd never bought him so much as a handkerchief. It was as if she expected him to create something out of nothing. Perhaps that was precisely the point. Nikolai snapped his fingers, and a black cravat tied itself expertly around his neck. Next, a blue paisley waistcoat, which Nikolai had made last month, buttoned itself around him. Then, finally, a black frock coat enveloped him, although he smiled smugly as he chose one with notched lapels, because Galina be damned, it was 2 in the morning, and if there was any time that was informal enough for notched lapels, it was in these dead-eyed hours between twilight and dawn. Oh, and a hat. He couldn't forget his top hat. Having dressed, Nikolai flicked his fingers at the door to open it. He strode down the hall, and seeing no sign of Galina, slid down the curved wooden banister to the first floor. The grandfather clock at the base of the stairs showed 4 minutes past the hour. Nikolai hurried across the Persian rug in the drawing room, through the foyer, dark since the candles in the chandelier were dormant, and out the front door. Galina was already tapping her high-heeled boot on what would be the cobblestones, had her feet actually touched the ground. But, of course, they didn't. Galina had always thought the ground was both literally and figuratively beneath her. She arched her brow as she took in Nikolai's notched lapels. Then, after just enough scrutiny to push him to the brink of cringing, she turned abruptly and started down the street, toward Yekaterinsky Canal, without giving any hint as to where she was headed, nor what she intended to do. Nikolai swore under his breath again, and hurried to follow. Chapter 4 They wound through streets lit only by occasional lamps, their reflections shimmering on the damp cobblestones. Galina led Nikolai past grand mansions with pastel facades and ornate windows trimmed in white and gold, over the stone bridges that traversed the city's many canals, which had earned St. Petersburg its nickname as the Venice of the North, and through grand squares empty of everything but bronze statues protecting the night. The dark closed in on Nikolai, and he pulled his coat tighter around himself. He thought again of his cozy bed. Where in the devil's name was Galina taking him? Eventually, they arrived at the front door of the Imperial Public Library, on the corner of Nevsky Prospect, the wide main boulevard of the city, and Sadovaya Street. The library was an immense stone building, painted powder blue, with white statues flanked by white columns. It housed national and foreign treasures, like Voltaire's personal library. And since Galina had not wanted to pay for Nikolai's enrollment at either a gymnasium or a military cadet school, Nikolai had educated himself in his scraps of free time within these very walls. The Imperial Public Library was one of his favorite places in the city. And now at 2:30 in the morning, the building somehow seemed even grander to him, looming like a shadow too colossal to be restrained.
"Please tell me you don't intend for me to break into the library."
Galina looked down at him, for she was now hovering a foot in the air, since there was no one in the streets at this hour other than drunks, whose hungover morning stories would never be believed. Which raised the question again of why Nikolai had to be dressed so neatly.
"As if I would so disrespect a national institution," Galina said. "No, I simply want you to reshelve some of the books inside. They have been misplaced."
"Reshelve them? Now? From outside?"
"Of course now, and of course from outside."
She threw her hands in the air.
"Do you think we're out here because I wanted a walking companion? The game will begin soon. You can feel it, can't you?"
"Can I?" Nikolai stuck out his tongue, as if he could taste the difference in the air. And in fact, he could. It was like cinnamon, with a dash of death. Nikolai's stomach, which was already unsettled from being denied sleep, sank to the bottom of his boots. Galina carried on as if her announcement about the game were ordinary news.
"There are 5 books slotted into the wrong spaces on the shelves."
Nikolai took a deep breath.
"Don't think about the game yet. Focus on this single task."
Besides, he was probably wrong about the air, for who'd ever heard of magic tasting like cinnamon? And taste buds that detected death were not to be trusted. Death wasn't a flavor or even a scent.
"What are the titles of the books?"
he asked Galina.
"You don't need them. This is about concentration, Nikolai, and working under pressure."
She glanced up at the sky, and even though it was still pitch black, but for the street lamps, she acted as if she could already see the sun's first rays.
"Tick tock. I estimate 3 hours, perhaps less, before the underlings of the city begin to scurry about on their errands, and someone reports you to the Tsar's guard."
Nikolai's stomach remained firmly splattered at the soles of his boots. There were hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of books in the library. And he had to find 5 that were out of order in 3 hours. He sank onto the corner of the street and leaned back against a flickering lamp.
"Don't be pathetic," Galina said. "Oh, and don't let anyone catch you charming anything, of course."
Nikolai barely nodded. This had been drummed into him every time she gave him a lesson in a public place. He had to protect his identity. Galina was quite certain the other enchanter didn't know Nikolai existed. But just in case, he had to hide who he was. It would give him the advantage of surprise when the game commenced. Of course, Galina hadn't bothered telling him who the other enchanter was, or how she knew in the first place.
"I'm a mentor,"
she'd said by way of non-explanatory explanation, invoking again her long bloodline of ancestors, whose task it was to train enchanters.
And in any case, it isn't important who the other enchanter is. It will only distract you from focusing on what is important. Making yourself the best enchanter you can be. Moreover, I'm quite sure my teaching is far superior to what the other mentor can offer. As long as you do as you're told, of course.
And so it went. Galina would make demands, and Nikolai would comply. Now she drifted away from the library, down Nevsky Prospect, in the direction from which they had come.
If only her lessons didn't take place in the middle of the night.
But Nikolai took a deep breath and cracked his knuckles. Exhaustion could be overcome. He'd done it plenty of times before. He tossed aside his self-pity and rose from where he'd sat against the street lamp. He focused on the Imperial Library's impenetrable walls.
Imagine they are transparent, he thought. Imagine the walls are nothing but air.
They held on to their solidness for a moment, and then the walls seemed to shimmer before evaporating from Nikolai's sight altogether, and he could see straight through them. At first, everything seemed too airy, too insubstantial, as if he'd entered a dimension inhabited solely by ghosts. But slowly, the rooms began to fill in, first the tables and chairs, then the columns and shelves, and finally, the books themselves. Nikolai gasped, seeing the hundreds of thousands of books now, when he had an impossible task to accomplish, was so much more daunting than in the past when he had browsed the shelves.
I'll never be able to sort through all of them.
Even if he had been physically inside the library, it would take weeks, perhaps months, to check all the spines to ensure they were in the proper order. If he were more powerful, he might have been able to command all the books in the library to fly off the shelves at once and direct them to reorder themselves correctly. But that was the sort of dream one had after too many glasses of wine, followed by too many shots of cheap vodka. In his mind, Nikolai walked through the inside of the library, from the more popular reading rooms full of newspapers and magazines to the rare documents room, which required special permission. At least, permission was required for those who could not see through walls and peruse the holdings in the middle of the night.
If I can isolate the books that have been touched within the last 24 hours, maybe not even that long, since Galina likely visited near the end of the day to minimize the risk of the librarians undoing her work, then I can command those books to reshelve themselves in the right places.
He clasped his hands in front of him, as if in prayer, and concentrated on catching the attention of every last book in the library.
If you were moved yesterday, I command you to move again now. Slide forward. Pull yourself off the shelf.
Nikolai held his breath. Some of the volumes quivered in place.
Slide forward. Pull yourself off the shelf.
He willed again. A few books started to move, just an inch. He knit his brow.
Slide forward. Pull yourself off the shelf.
And then, all at once, a few hundred books leaped off the shelves and came to a sudden halt, suspended in midair. Nikolai smiled.
Now go back to your places,
he commanded the books. They did nothing but hover. Nikolai twisted his mouth. It would not be as simple as he'd hoped, for his plan apparently didn't work if the books weren't told specifically where to go. Still, it was only a few hundred books. He could do that. He could check the numbers on the spines against the numbers of the adjacent books, push back the ones that belonged, and pluck out the ones that did not.
Unless a convention of anarchists visited the library yesterday, most books ought to be in their rightful spaces.
And so Nikolai began the painstaking sorting. The first book was a Russian dictionary. The books on the shelf behind it were all labeled with the same classification number.
You may slide back.
It obeyed and slotted itself neatly in place. The next several books were similarly in their corresponding spaces. Apparently, they had just been taken off the shelves to be perused, but the patrons had put them back correctly. After 45 minutes, though, Nikolai had not found a single misplaced book. He rubbed the back of his neck. Perhaps this strategy wasn't any good. Perhaps the charm he'd cast on the books was faulty. But it was creeping toward 4 in the morning now, too close to when the city would wake, and Nikolai couldn't start all over. He had to press on before he was discovered. The next book floating off its shelf was a manual on the cultivation of wheat. But it had been placed beside economic treatises, which was clearly wrong, even without comparing the numbers on the spines.
Finally,
he said aloud. Nikolai directed the wheat manual several aisles down to its brethren. 1 down, 4 to go. But a pair of voices sounded from around the corner of Sadovaya Street. Nikolai inhaled sharply, then darted around the other corner of the library and pressed himself against the wall. It was a couple of fishermen staggering home, or perhaps to the docks on the banks of the Neva River, after a long night at a tavern. They stopped a mere foot from where Nikolai stood holding his breath and every muscle. One of the drunkards unfastened his trousers and relieved himself on the street lamp. The other laughed and undid his trousers too, but he aimed his stream at the other man's.
You murderless bastard!
The first fisherman waved his own stream like a stuttering liquid saber at the others. A urine duel commenced.
Deuces, were they 8 years old?
The fishermen convulsed with laughter as they battled with their stinking yellow swords. Nikolai plastered himself flatter against the wall, as the second drunkard's aim grew even worse and came within inches of Nikolai's boots. Finally, they finished and tottered on their merry, unfettered way. Only when their sloppy footfalls receded did Nikolai allow himself to exhale. He worked at a quicker tempo thereafter and found 3 more books in the wrong sections. Only 1 misplaced title remained. But Nikolai was no longer the only person on the street. It was now 4:15, and others had begun trickling past. Nevsky Prospect was, after all, one of the busiest streets in the city. And those people had begun casting strange glances at the well-dressed young gentleman who stood as if in a trance on the corner of Nevsky Prospect and Sadovaya Street. A flower girl across the street eyed him. She waved over a man carrying several crates of apples.
Now or never, Nikolai thought.
There were only 30 or so books that needed to be checked. He was not powerful enough to handle the movement of an entire library of books, but surely he could handle 30. He clasped his hands even tighter in front of him and murmured, almost to himself,
"Return to your proper places, all of you."
Inside the library, 2 dozen books shot straight back into their spaces. 5 or 6, on the other hand, whizzed through the air, a couple nearly colliding with each other, and weaved their way through the library, back to their correct rooms, correct aisles, correct shelves. Nikolai dropped his arms to his sides, and blinked when it was done. All he could do now was hope that the misfiled books he'd found included the 5 Galina had shuffled herself. The apple man set down his crates and began to march toward Nikolai. Nikolai spun on his heels and hurried down the street.
You, sir!
the apple man yelled, not at all polite despite his use of the word sir. Nikolai did not turn around. Instead, he careened around a corner and darted into an alleyway. He checked around him, left, right, up, down, to make sure no one was watching from a doorway or window. Then he passed his hand over the length of his body from head to toe, and cast over himself the illusion that his gentlemanly clothes were actually those of a working man. Top hat to crushed bowler hat, frock coat to suit of coarse flannel, cravat to stained handkerchief, and so on, down to the frayed laces of his worn brown boots. When Nikolai emerged from the alley, the apple man ran right by him. Nikolai exhaled for the thousandth time since Galina had dragged him out into the night. And now, finally, he could go home and sleep. That is, if Galina did not have another surprise there, waiting for him. Chapter 5 Yuliana glided down the halls of the Winter Palace, past white columns and crystal chandeliers, and all manner of gold gilt on the walls. If she were any other 15-year-old girl, she would run. But she was the Grand Princess of Russia, and royalty did not run. Well, actually, her older brother, Pavel Alexandrovich Romanov, was running down the hall ahead of her, even though it was unbecoming of a crown prince. But Yuliana was not Pasha. That was what his family and closest friends called him, in almost every way. Yuliana cared about economics and politics. She was carrying an enormous, rolled-up map at this very moment. And Pasha cared about hunting and reading. He was quick to smile and chatty with all the servants, whereas she had the propriety to maintain the hierarchy of her royal rank. And his hair was always a mess. No, Yuliana was nothing like Pasha, and thank goodness for that. The Russian Empire needed at least one Romanov in this generation with her head screwed on straight. Pasha waited for her at the heavy gold doors that marked the entrance to their father's study, not even out of breath. Two members of the Tsar's guard stood at attention, one on either side. They had likely already bowed to Pasha. He was the Cesarevich, after all. But they bowed again when they saw Yuliana.
"Is father occupied?"
she asked one of the guards.
"He is meeting with the Tsarina, your Imperial Highness."
"Then we'll come back later,"
Pasha said.
"No, we won't."
Yuliana shoved open the doors before her brother or the guards could protest. Not that they would. They'd long ago learned that it was better to allow Yuliana her own way than to suffer her wrath. The Tsarina jumped in her armchair at the sound of the doors flinging open, then burst into a fit of coughs. The Tsar merely looked up from his desk and sighed.
"Yuliana, how many times have I asked you to have the guards announce you properly? Look what you've done to your mother." "Elizabeth," he said to the Tsarina, "are you all right?"
Yuliana glanced at the Tsarina. A pale blue handkerchief was pressed to her even paler face, her elegant hands shaking as she convulsed.
"My apologies, mother. I didn't mean to frighten you."
Yuliana turned back to the Tsar.
"But Pasha has just returned, and he has much to say about the Kazakh steppe. It's rather alarming."
Pasha came up laughing behind her.
"Only slightly more alarming than the way you enter a room."
Yuliana shot him one of her famous scowls. It only made him laugh more.
"Ugh, brothers."
The Tsar sat back in his chair, which, although simpler, seemed as much a throne as the one in the official throne room.
"Your mother was in the middle of discussing plans for Pasha's upcoming birthday," he said.
When he frowned, he looked a lot like Yuliana. Or Yuliana looked a lot like him. Severe blonde statues, straight out of ancient Rome.
It's all right,
the Tsarina said, having finally stopped coughing. She gathered her voluminous silver skirts and rose.
I was finished.
Mother, Pasha said, don't go. What I have to say can wait.
It really can't,
Yuliana said. The Tsarina smiled and kissed Yuliana on the top of her carefully coiffed ringlets, then stood on her tiptoes to peck Pasha on the cheek.
It's fine, love. Talk to your father.
The Tsarina smiled at the Tsar too, and she departed the room. Yuliana set her map, still rolled up, for now, against her father's desk, and sat in the armchair her mother had vacated. It hadn't a trace of warmth, as if it were too much to ask the Tsarina's tiny, sickly body to produce enough heat to warm the cushions. But Yuliana pushed that out of her head. What was important right now was the Kazakhs and getting the Tsar to do something about them.
Father, what I...
The Tsar put up a hand.
Yuliana, why don't you let Pasha speak? It's he who was on the step, was it not?
Yes, well...
But she gestured at Pasha. But this was why she'd dragged him here in the first place, even though he'd wanted to go out to see his friends as soon as he'd arrived back in St. Petersburg.
So, the Tsar said to Pasha, I received word that Kasim refused to sup with you.
Indeed, father,
Pasha said, breaking a hand through his hair, tousling it in that casually defiant way that all the girls of the nobility seemed to love.
Like waves of gold,
Yuliana had overheard Baroness Tsarina's daughter say at a recent tea. Yuliana had wanted to punch her in her vapid face.
Although I abolished their Khanate, the Tsar said, the Kazakhs still look to Kasim as their leader. I sent you to dine with him for a reason, Pasha. I needed you to gather information for me, especially after the Kazakhs attacked our Cossack detachments earlier this year.
Pasha leaned against one of their father's bookcases, his elbows behind him as support.
But I learned what we needed to know, even without meeting with Kasim.
How? The Tsar said.
I have my ways,
Pasha smiled. The Tsar rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands.
I don't think I want to know your methods, he said.
No, father. Trust me. You do not.
Yuliana tried not to smile. In general, she did not believe in smiles. But she couldn't help it, because her brother brought them out of her. And Pasha had already told Yuliana the how of his espionage. Pasha was notorious for slipping out of the palace in plain clothes, masquerading as one of the common people, so he could waste his time playing cards with fishermen on the dock, or frequenting taverns with his friend Nikolai Karimov. It was no different on the Kazakh steppe, where Pasha had left his officer's uniform at the army's camp, and sneaked out in a plain tunic and trousers. Then he'd wandered through the main trading post, posing as an innocent traveller. He passed stalls full of brightly coloured caps, flat on top, and intricately embroidered on the sides. There was a table that specialised in dried apricots, and another with sacks full of grain. It was around the corner from the butcher's stall, however, that Pasha stopped and loitered. A cluster of men gathered around the butcher, who held a cleaver over a side of lamb. The butcher was the youngest among them, 25 at the most, but he seemed to hold court over the others. Perhaps it was his hatchet of a knife that did it.
The rations are a pestilence,
one man said.
Yes, a pestilence, a plague,
another added.
They think they can draw arbitrary borders and forbid us from migrating across them. We will not stand for it.
Patience, the butcher said. The plans for revolt are underway.
Kasim's men are prepared.
I hope so,
the first man said.
Without a doubt,